Welcome to Hey Siri, a podcast about psychology, relationships, and most importantly, piping hot tea. Sit down, take a sip, and remember to subscribe as resident pop culture expert Xochi and struggling PhD student Siri take you through the what, why, and how of relationship research and what that means for your non-scientifically researched relationships. All of this research is coming out all the time, but academic literature can be intimidating and difficult to connect to real life. So let us do it for you.
Siri will tell us all about what research is taking the psychology world by storm. On today's episode, she will tell us all about long-term relationships. What traits are important in a long-term partner? Why isn't attractiveness one of them? How can you show your partner you're in it for the long haul?
After hearing the research on long-term relationships, Xochi will baselessly speculate on people we do not know, celebrities. Today, Xochi will be discussing the everlasting love between Kirk and Anne Douglas. Okay, starting out with the research first, as usual, I found this really interesting article called Partners' Traits, which Motivate People to Stay in an Intimate Relationship, an Explorative Analysis. And this was written by Menelaus Apostolou and Christophorus Christophorou, who have amazing names.
That's a fake name.
Because they're in Greece.
His name is not Christophorus Christophorou.
Yeah. And it was published in the journal Personality and Individual Differences in 2021. And I don't know how I keep finding articles that are qualitative, because they're not actually that common in psychology, but this is another qualitative article. So they did like interviews and things like that with their participants.
You know, we're doing a lot of like really classic dating questions and topics, so I feel like everyone's pretty aware of them.
Yes, but these authors actually took a different route than most of the articles I read. And we can talk more about that later. So just, you know, basically an overview. The authors of this paper were interested in what specific traits in a romantic partner motivate people to stay in relationships for the long term and influence their perception of the relationship as one that could last for a very long time. And here is where it differs from the research that I usually engage with. They start out by grounding their paper in evolutionary theory. And this wasn't part of the paper, but I think a quote by sort of renowned evolutionary psychologist David Buss describes this perspective very well. So he said, one of his foundational quotes is, "From an evolutionary perspective, no single decision is more important than the choice of a mate. That single fork in the road determines one's ultimate reproductive fate." So the thing about evolutionary theory in the field of psychology is that it assumes that the number one priority for people is reproducing with an appropriate mate who will stay with you and raise and care for your children.
I was about to say, that kind of takes away most of the mitigating factors for modern dating. I don't think all of us are looking for a provider.
There's a lot of criticism of this theory. Like one of the most basic is that it's kind of this idea of behavioral determinism, meaning that you don't have free will. And that's kind of weird. And then also, obviously, it doesn't account for same-sex orientation. Same-sex couples, even just same-sex attraction, but specifically same-sex couples who do want children. It has no explanation for that. Or sexual behaviors that don't contribute to reproduction, like masturbation. Or, like, I mean, it kind of counts.
Sounds a little eugenics-y.
It accounts for, like, casual sex, but only for men. And we know that from very recent research that, and in fact, I just cited an article the other day that showed that the frequency of hookup behavior is basically identical across men and women.
So there's maybe a little bit of like Freud going on here.
It's definitely not Freud. Freud was more of the, he was more woo-woo. Like actually evolutionary perspective is like, we are science, this is biology, like this is how it is. And it does get, some of its explanations are good, and then a lot of it is just doesn't really make much sense. I am in an attachment lab, so yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of criticism of evolutionary theory, but there's also some stuff that makes sense. And that's what I want to discuss next, because the way they discuss it in this paper actually does make a lot of sense. So, according to evolutionary theory, you want to find a long-term intimate relationship so that your children will have the best possible chance of survival with the investment of two reliable parental figures. And if you wanted to take that out of like science jargon, you could just say you want to have children with someone who would be a good parent, which I think a lot of people do look for. They think like, you know, would my partner make a good mom or dad?
Yeah. If you want children and you're getting into a relationship for like to have children, I can definitely see whether or not your partner is a good parent, would be a deciding factor in that.
Yeah, but the thing with evolutionary psych is that like its whole thing is reproduction. So like there's definitely other forces. Like when you when you want to marry someone, right, it's not your only goal that they'll be a good parent, but that's kind of what they're saying here. So to that end, the authors propose that selection forces, so basically like the process of evolution, have influenced people to choose their reproductive partners based on whether they think that partner will increase their chances of having and raising healthy children to adulthood. And they make these judgments about the partner based on the intimate partner's traits that they can observe. So previous research has identified certain partner traits that are likely to increase reproductive fitness, such as like being kind and understanding, being hardworking, healthy, intelligent, reliable, and wealthy, and having an interesting and pleasant personality, and so on. Just like things that make you think like, oh yeah, this is a good person. That's a
That
good
was a very
person.
good list.
And one thing you'll notice right off the bat is that being attractive is not one of these traits.
Yeah, I did notice that.
Yeah.
So they can be uggos.
And the authors will kind of speculate on this later, but you can see if you agree with their speculation. So it's also beneficial for an intimate partner to display a long-term mating strategy. So an example of this would be dating and committing to a romantic relationship instead of participating in like friends with benefits or another type of casual sex relationship, which would be an example of short-term mating strategies. And the authors hypothesize that partner traits that are associated with long-term mating strategies, like reliability, commitment, trust, and faithfulness, will actually be seen as more important than other desirable traits like intelligence. And I put attractiveness here, but we just discussed it's probably not attractiveness. So it'd be like intelligence or being like healthy. Because traits associated with long-term mating strategies are so closely associated with a higher chance of the partner sticking around to provide for and raise children. And the authors cite a bunch of literature that supports this theory retroactively. So in samples of couples who have been together for a really long time, some variation of these traits were rated as the most important. So, like in one study, they found that people thought that faithfulness was most important. In another study, people who had been in a relationship for at least 20 years thought that like reliability and commitment were the most important. So these are consistently identified as like really important traits in long-term relationships.
Those are kind of the same thing.
What are?
Like commitment and reliability and faithfulness.
I think they're all getting
You know,
it.
like your old faithful.
Yeah, well, they're getting it slightly different things. So faithfulness would be not cheating. Commitment would be commitment would be like agreeing to remain in a marriage. Reliability would be like being there for you when you need them throughout the marriage. So they're like slightly different, you know what I mean?
Can you be fully committed while not being faithful?
Yes, because you could be committed to the marriage and still be cheating. You could say, I don't want a divorce. And that's
That's
maybe,
weird.
you know, where something, I don't know. Evolutionary theorists wouldn't like polyamory, but that may be where something like that comes in. But they would,
Ethical non-monogamy.
yeah, but evolutionary theorists would be very confused by that. Although they would like the idea of having another parental figure. Like, more parental figures is always better.
Yeah, it takes a village.
So the purpose of the current study was to identify specific intimate partner traits that motivate people to stay in a relationship long term. And they used an exploratory method. So in their first study, they collected qualitative, so written or interview data from participants about what individual traits would enable them to continue a relationship with a romantic partner. Then in the second study, they classified these traits that were identified by the participants into broader factors or categories and tested whether having a partner with these traits was associated with relationship longevity and the perception of the relationship as being one that could be long-lasting. And they also had a focus on gender differences because they wondered if it might be different between men and women, because evolutionary psychology is all about the gender differences. So first, taking a look at study one, they recruited participants through advertisements on social media, which, as we're seeing, is a common theme. And their participants took part in one of two conditions. Either they did an open-ended questionnaire, meaning that they got questions and they were asked to like write in in-depth answers, or they did an in-depth interview. So as expected, because interviews require a lot of commitment and time, they only got 20 participants total for the in-depth interview, 10 men and 10 women, with an average age of 37.
That's a little older than we've been looking at, too, I guess, because they have had to have been in a relationship for a while.
Well, they took anyone. In this one, actually, they didn't even require them to be in a romantic relationship because they would ask them about past partners. But I'm guessing that, I don't know, maybe it's some age thing about being willing to participate in an in-depth interview about your experiences, I guess.
Yeah, maybe.
On the other hand, 187 participants agreed to take their open-ended questionnaire, which may have been just as long once you ended up writing, but maybe seems like less commitment.
To go anywhere?
Yeah, well, I think they did this pencil and paper in their lab.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm, I think so. Yeah.
That's strange.
I know. So of the 187 participants who did the open-ended questionnaire, 84 were men and 103 were women. So again, like we've seen consistently, there is this tendency for women to be more likely to participate in research. And these individuals had an average age of 25. So that is a lot
that's younger.
Yeah. Interesting. So almost 100% of the participants who did the in-depth interview were in a romantic relationship at the time, compared to a little over half of the participants in the open-ended questionnaire condition. So that's another difference there. So in both the conditions, they collected demographic information, and they specifically asked for age, gender, and marital status. In the in-depth interview condition, I'm so sorry, my husband is here interrupting the podcast.
Wow.
Bye. Don't edit that out. So
should we just start over? Or?
Stop. Don't make me start over. So in both the conditions, they collected demographic information, so age, gender, and marital status. So interestingly, like not a lot of demographics compared to a lot of studies I've seen. They didn't look at race. They didn't look at socioeconomic status, household income. There's just these three variables. In the in-depth interview condition, they asked participants to discuss traits that their past and current romantic partners had and identified which of those traits motivated them to stay in the relationship. And in the open-ended questionnaire condition, they were asked to write down as many positive traits as you can that your current and previous partners had and motivated you to continue the relationship with them. And that sentence sounds a little awkward, but I think it's because it was originally written in Greek, and they translated it to English for the paper.
Oh, there you go.
Right. So participants...
I'm forgetting we're in Greece.
Yeah, the participants saw it in Greek, and I'm sure it sounded normal. So the answers from both conditions were then categorized by two researchers. They were actually research assistants who were not credited as authors on the paper.
It was stolen.
And they added similar answers to the same categories. So the researchers first categorized the answers independently and then checked with each other to determine how much they agreed. And in cases where they disagreed, and they like one of them said, oh, I think it should be in this category. And the other person said, oh, I think it should be this one. They consulted one of the authors to settle the issue. They ended up with a total of 75 traits that would motivate people to stay in a romantic relationship. Yeah, a lot. And if you go to the paper, if you're interested, you can go to the paper and see all of them. But they were categorized into the following larger factors. Those were committed to me, well off, gives me sexual satisfaction, makes compromises, faithful and trustworthy, good cook slash housekeeper, positive, fun to be with, and does well with my friends and family.
Yeah, those all sound pretty good.
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of a range there. And then once they had those factors that they validated using factor analysis, which is the statistical process to make sure that, you know, everything is kosher, they conducted study two. So again, they recruited their participants via social media and emails. And this time they required their participants to be in a romantic relationship at the time of the study. And this time they ended up with a sample of 1,189 individuals.
Oh, damn.
Right. 511 men and 675 women, and then three people who didn't indicate their gender. So the average age was 36 for women and 41 for men, and about half of the participants were married. So the other half were in a romantic relationship that was committed, but just weren't married. And yeah, so yeah, it was interesting that only half were actually married. So they asked their participants to first rate their current romantic partner on each of the 75 traits identified in study one, indicating the extent to which they agreed that their partner showed each trait on a scale from 1, meaning strongly disagree, to 5, meaning strongly agree. Which must have taken so long. Then they completed the relationship assessment scale, which measured their relationship satisfaction. And then finally, they asked them to rate two statements about the potential longevity of their relationship and the difficulty of remaining in the relationship on a scale from 1, meaning not at all, to 5, meaning very much.
Uh-oh.
So, you know, do you feel that you have a lot of difficulty remaining in the relationship? And they would put like 5, meaning like, yeah. And then they also collected demographic information. So in this case, they asked for their gender, age, marital status, and the number of years they had been in the relationship. Then they reported on their findings. So 68% of their participants indicated that their partner was faithful and trustworthy, and 61% said that their partner was committed to me. But only 21% of participants indicated that their partner was well off. Yeah, so people may see this, and the other results will show this. People may see being well off kind of abstractly as like, oh yeah, that's important to me. It doesn't actually bear out when you're choosing a romantic partner to stay with. The perception of the partner as faithful and trustworthy and as someone who does well with my friends and family were really strongly associated with relationship longevity. So those two traits are really important. Interestingly, the partner traits fun to be with and gives me sexual satisfaction, when you looked at a direct association, they were associated with shorter relationship length.
I can see that.
And probably what this is that if fun to be with and gives me sexual satisfaction, those are two things that kind of excitability and the focus on like sex and sexual activity are usually found in shorter relationships, like new couples, not shorter relationships that are broken up, but new couples, those things tend to be important for them.
I see what you're saying. Okay. And so like, that gets less important the longer you're in a relationship.
Yeah. After 20 years, you know, them being fun to be with, like fun and exciting to be with, and, you know, giving you sexual satisfaction maybe are not as important. Just because you have other things that are important, like you can talk to them and they understand you and, you know, all this other stuff.
Right. I mean, after like 4 years, you're like, I get it. I know you.
Yeah, exactly. Like we don't have to be fun all the time, right? Like, exactly. So that actually makes sense. Their analyses indicated that participants who saw their partners as faithful and trustworthy, as being able to give me sexual satisfaction and as fun to be with, were more satisfied with their relationship, and this high satisfaction was in turn associated with the perception that the relationship would last long term. So,
right, because you're so happy in it, you're thinking this is just going to keep going.
Yes. So we talked about mediators, I think, in the first podcast. So in technical terms, relationship satisfaction would be the mediator. So it explains the relationship between the traits and the perception of the relationship as long term. So just like you said, the reason that people whose partners possess these traits see their relationship as potentially lasting a long time is because these traits make them happy in the relationship. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. They also found that perception of a romantic partner as possessing the traits faithful and trustworthy, committed to me, common interests, and makes compromises was associated with less difficulty sustaining the relationship. So, I mean, that all makes sense. Each of those, if you don't have, would be like if your partner's cheating on you, or if they're not committed to you, or if you have nothing in common, no one's compromising, of course, that would, you know, be associated with difficulties.
Right.
And the traits well-off and good cook/housekeeper were associated with more difficulty sustaining the relationship.
You know, I think it's also because, like, qualities like faithful and trustworthy and committed to me and making compromises and having common interests are kind of like full-time, lifelong mm-hmm. sort of things that are intrinsic to their personality, whereas well-off and being a good cook or housekeeper aren't really. Because if you are a good cook or housekeeper but you're not committed to your partner or make compromises with your partner, then they may never experience your good cooking or housekeeping.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. They also did find a few gender differences in their results, and interestingly, one of them has to do with the good cook/housekeeper, and also like the fun to be with and faithful and trustworthy. Like, there was a couple things. So the traits gives me sexual satisfaction and makes compromises only positively predicted length of the relationship for men. So what that indicates is that for women, those are less important, which is why they had no association with the length of the relationship.
Right.
That's like maybe one explanation. The trait committed to me only predicted less difficulties in sustaining the relationship for women, which is also, I don't even know what that would be. The traits faithful and trustworthy, positive, fun to be with, and good cook/housekeeper only predicted the perception of the relationship as long-lasting or having the potential to be long-lasting for men. And the trait does well with my friends and family only predicted the perception of the relationship as potentially long-lasting for women.
Oh my God.
And then, like, these are, like, I don't know, it's very interesting, kind of random, like, inconsistent. And then finally, the trait good cook/housekeeper only predicted a longer relationship length for men.
And this came out in the year 2021?
Yeah. But those I'm going to put down to gender socialization, like, for sure. Because Greece is a more conservative area, which I think maybe they should have mentioned. It was a very good article, though. So, what does this all mean? Well, first of all, it supports the assumption, based on evolutionary theory, that people see partner traits that are linked to long-term mating strategies as predictive of long-lasting relationships, like being faithful and trustworthy, fun to be with, and making compromises. One thing that they didn't look at was, or that they didn't record data on, was whether these participants were same-sex oriented or other sex oriented or bisexual. So it's unclear whether this transcends sexual orientation, which I would be very interested to know.
Yeah, because it doesn't really support evolutionary theory at its core.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other things besides these, like, long-term mating strategy associated traits that were associated with length of relationship. And there's a lot of couples that are deciding not to have kids. So, I don't know. I feel like that maybe they should have accounted for things. Like, I would have been interested to see them include same sexual orientation in their analyses, and whether or not they wanted children and whether or not they had children.
Right.
That's what I wanted to see. Interestingly, although the trait well-off was described as desirable by, like, a ton of participants in the first study, which is why it, like, got its own factor in the second study, it did not predict relationship longevity, either just, like, how long they'd been in the relationship or how their perception of the relationship as having the potential to be long-term. It didn't predict, like, any of that. And
so that reads to me as, like, it would be nice, but it's a bonus.
Yeah, it could, you know what, it could be something like that, which I really agree with. The author's explanation for this was that maybe the capacity to produce resources was more important than actually producing a lot of resources. So, like, the trait faithful and trustworthy is associated with conscientiousness and responsibility, and that was really important. And so if you have a partner who you see as faithful and trustworthy, they're likely conscientious, they're likely responsible. So even if they don't have a well-paying job, those traits probably mean that they're able to maintain that job over time and, you know, contribute to the relationship over time. So it may be that being, like, wealthy is not important. It's, are you a hard worker? Are you responsible?
Right.
That kind of thing. Interestingly, and I've mentioned this, you know, throughout this whole discussion, attractiveness didn't emerge as a distinct desirable trait. So they suggested that maybe the kind of, like, evaluation of the partner as attractive may happen even before you decide to get in a relationship with them. So, like, it's not important to you and a romantic partner because they wouldn't be your romantic partner if they weren't attractive.
That's very fair.
Or maybe the gives me sexual satisfaction trait was kind of a proxy for good looks. Like, that was tied up into that. But they did specifically mention that future research should try to explicitly examine the association between looks and relationship longevity, because in evolutionary theory, actually, looks are very important, are considered, like, a very important part of choosing a mate. So that does not line up with evolutionary theory.
That's very funny.
Because in evolutionary theory, I don't know. First of all, sexual satisfaction isn't brought up much because that's not considered important, because it's considered a biological drive. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's interesting that evolutionary theorists are doing research on long-term relationships, because that doesn't seem like something that would really matter.
No. In evolutionary theorists' eyes, long-term relationships are, like, the only valid relationships. That's what everyone should be striving
for. As long as you
for.
Have kids, like, you're good.
No, because you want your kids to survive, and to survive, they have the best chance of surviving if both parents are involved in the rearing and providing.
I see.
And
I see.
Also, if you're in a long-term relationship as a male, you know that those children are yours, which is very important in evolutionary theory, like, knowing the paternity.
This seems like a strange field.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's got some very controversial figures. Actually, we just went over this with my class the other week, that some very controversial figures in evolutionary psychology, they're just, like, tend to be kind of, like, rude sometimes. Some of the big people, they're, like, mostly men. So it's an interesting field.
I can see that. Was that what Darwinism is? Is that what Darwin was doing?
Darwin was mostly a biologist. So, like, evolutionary theory, I think, is different in biology, because, like, we think of Darwin as being survival of the fittest. When you look at evolutionary theory in psychology, it's actually, like, reproduction of the fittest. So, I don't know. But honestly, I only took up to, like, bio 102, so. Don't quote me.
Someone told me how babies were made in high school, and I thought that was enough science for me. Thank you.
We're going over that with my class next week.
Oh, God. Lucky you.
Oh, my goodness.
Alrighty. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Evolutionary theory, interesting. Funnily enough, that whole, like, hardworking thing, mm-hmm. I think is supported by this couple, and I think also committed to me will come into play in this couple. So also, for full transparency, there are
quite a few amazing long-term couples in Hollywood. It isn't really thought of as a thing, but I think that's because we either forget that some of these people are married, kind of, mm-hmm. or their partners, you know, I don't know why it is, but I found quite a few, and that I want to talk
about. Wait, because you don't hear about them, right? Because it's, like, not news that, oh, hey, they've been together for 29 years.
Okay. Exactly, unless they, like, do something crazy for their vow renewal. It's kind of like, yep, that's you. That's what you agreed to. So, there were four couples I want to talk about, but the Douglases won out because they had been together the longest. And I've also been trying to keep the celeb gossip a little more current, and Kirk Douglas sadly passed away last year at the age of 103, and in April of this year, we lost Anne at 102.
Wow. That's very old.
They've been popping up recently. Yeah. So let's talk about them. Oh, but also an honorable mention real quick to Denzel and Pauletta Washington, who have been together for 39 years. Samuel L. Jackson and LaTanya Richardson, who have been together for 36 years. And Tina Turner and Erwin Bach, who have been together for 30 years.
Okay.
All wonderful. I was considering all of them for this. And now let's go through the timeline of Kirk and Anne's relationship, which lasted more than 66 years.
That is a really long-term relationship. You know, we were talking last time about, like, oh, the research doesn't even look at age gaps that are that big. The research doesn't even look at long-term relationships that last.
It's like 66 years.
Over 60 years.
You're dead. But actually, they did die married.
Yeah.
I guess. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It would have been 67 if he could have just stuck it out.
Seriously?
A little while longer.
Just like one more year? Okay.
So, I'm assuming you don't know who Kirk Douglas is.
I have no idea.
I'm actually assuming many people have not heard of him because he is from a previous era, I will say. Mm-hmm. So, who's Kirk Douglas? Kirk Douglas was a Jewish-American actor, producer, director, screenwriter, and philanthropist. He grew up in severe poverty, but after making his film debut in the movie The Strange Love of Martha Ivers in 1946, his acting career blew up and he became known as the leading man whose movies are box office hits. He went on to appear in more than 90 films in his career and was known and beloved for his explosive style of acting.
So wait, how long was his career? Because if his marriage is 66 years, it sounds like he's a committed person.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that, because they met while he was sort of in the height of his acting career.
Okay.
And that played an interesting role in them getting together.
Mm-hmm.
The American Film Institute named him the 17th greatest male star of classic Hollywood cinema, and he was one of the last film icons from what is known as the film industry's golden age. He played opposite stars like Doris Day, Lauren Bacall, and many others, and worked with directors and writers like Stanley Kubrick and Dalton Trumbo. And if you haven't heard of any of these people, you may at least know his son, Michael Douglas, who is also a famous actor.
Okay, what has Michael Douglas been in?
You don't know Michael Douglas?
I'm sure I'll know if you tell me, like, what movies he's been in.
Yeah, I feel like he's one of those people where you know him if you can, like, see him and look at him. He looks a lot like, I'm blanking right now. But he was married to Catherine Zeta-Jones, which is when he first got onto, like, radar.
Why am I thinking that he was, like, in Spider-Man? He was not in Spider-Man, was he?
In Spider-Man? No, I don't think so.
Oh, he was in Fatal Attraction, Basic Instinct. Yeah. Okay.
He looks a lot like Macaulay Culkin.
You think so? Maybe the eyes.
You don't?
Just the eyes. He looks healthier.
Oh. So that's his son, mm-hmm. one of four, Michael Douglas, who's also a famous actor. He has been, his father, we're still talking about Kirk Douglas here, has been honored by governments and organizations of various countries, including France, Italy, Portugal, Israel, and Germany.
Wow.
In 1981, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Jimmy Carter. In 1984, he was inducted into the Western Performers Hall of Fame at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I'm not quite sure why. I don't think he's from Oklahoma.
But do you know why he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom?
For his philanthropy and, you know, sometimes actors in Britain get knighted
after doing so good for the representation of the country.
Okay.
But I think his, in particular, was for that and philanthropy on top of that.
Yeah.
You know what? I do need to find out if he's from Oklahoma, because why would he win that award?
Maybe he was in a movie in Oklahoma. Let's see. Kirk Douglas. Okay, I'm going to look at his Wikipedia.
Oh, no. He's from Amsterdam. So what?
Maybe he just really liked Oklahoma.
That's very interesting. But he, despite being from Amsterdam, he was still inducted into the Western Performers Hall of Fame at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. In 1990, he received the French Legion of Honor for distinguished services to France in arts and letters. Interesting.
Hmm.
That's a very specific distinction. In 1991, he won a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 1998, he received the Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2002, he received the National Medal of Arts Award from President Bush. In October 2004, Kirk Douglas Way, a thoroughfare in Palm Springs, California, was unveiled by the city's International Film Society and Film Festival. And he has a star on Hollywood Boulevard, which I still think is the coolest thing ever.
Of course he does. Are they still putting stars in?
Well, I said no, and then you corrected me saying that Ryan Reynolds just got one, which I didn't even know.
Yeah, like 4 years ago, but like now.
Oh, well, no one since. Maybe he was the last icon revealed.
Hmm.
I suppose it takes a while to decide, huh?
Yeah.
Here's how you kind of know that the Oscars are a little bit bullshit. He's never won an Academy Award.
For any of his 90 movies, you'd think by pure chance he would get an Academy
Award.
This
man has like 5 lifetime achievements. None of those achievements have been an Academy Award.
Oh my God.
But in 1996, he received an honorary award for 50 years as a creative and moral force in the motion picture community, which is just a spin in the face. Give him an Oscar. Are you kidding me? an honorary award from the Academy? Thank you.
You're very moral.
He does have 3 Golden Globes, a BAFTA Award, a Britannia Award, and many other accolades. He also wrote quite a few books, including The Ragman's Son, which is about himself, and The Gift, which I don't think is about him. And I included a few photos for Siri to see. One of them is from the 1960 film Spartacus.
Oh my goodness.
I love his costume. I love the singular
the
arm of chainmail.
One chainmail arm, and then like a loincloth.
I just realized, actually, both of the photos I included for you to see him, he's wearing basically underwear. That wasn't even intentional.
Oh, I just assumed that's what he regularly wore.
He was very often seen in these things.
Is that
his
wife?
He's very handsome. No, in a film.
Oh, okay.
There, he's acting there. Doesn't he look like he's acting so hard?
His pecs are popping.
He's acting. So, who is Ann Douglas? Ann Douglas, also known as Ann Boydens? But she was born as Hannelore Marks, which is a sick name.
Wait, can I just say, when I looked up Kirk Douglas on Wikipedia, it showed his original name.
Which is like Izzy something?
Isur Danielovich.
Yes. He's very Jewish.
He is Jewish.
And she's very German, Ms. Hannelore Marks.
Oh my goodness.
She was a philanthropist and producer. She was born in Germany. Her father was a textile merchant and her mother was a socialite. And after they got divorced, she went to boarding school in Switzerland where she learned English, French, and Italian.
Jesus,
I barely speak English. Very cool. She went on to study in Brussels, but fled to Paris during World War II. Her German identity became a problem, and so she married a Belgian man to gain citizenship and later divorced him. He was like a friend of hers, I think.
Okay.
And she was actually married to him when she met Kirk.
Hmm.
And he was dating someone else very seriously about to propose to her.
Kirk Douglas was?
Interesting. Yes.
Oh, he's interesting.
When they met. So she began her work in the film industry using her language skills to subtitle French films in German at the direction of Nazis, and later went on to produce series and worked as a location scout for the iconic film Moulin Rouge and organized celebrity parties for the Cannes Film Festival. Lots of fun stuff.
So she was working for the Nazis at one point?
No, she...
So Nazis had taken control of France at this point. She had previously fled the Nazis from Germany to Paris. When they took control of France, they insisted that all movies be dubbed in German.
Oh, that makes sense.
So she wasn't directly working for the Nazis, but at their direction, I suppose.
Right. She was, they, where she lived was under Nazi rule.
Yes.
Okay.
Unfortunate. So in 1953, she first met Kirk Douglas while she was producing the film he starred in, Act of Love, where he offered her a job as his publicist. Although she originally declined, she later reconsidered and accepted the position. According to Kirk, quote, she finally agreed to work with me on a trial basis, making it clear our relationship would be strictly business.
Maybe for the first few years.
I don't think that lasted. Anne was a respected philanthropist. One of her first projects began after she recovered from breast cancer. She and six other women established the Research for Women's Cancers charity, which raised millions of dollars to help finance a research facility at Cedar Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles.
That is, like, a premier, like, research hospital, Cedar Sinai.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
In recognition of her compassion towards homeless women, the Anne Douglas Center for Women was named after her. And she and her husband also founded the Douglas Foundation in 1964, which has since donated roughly $118 million to institutions such as the Children's Hospital Los Angeles and the Motion Picture and Television Fund. Wow. They were also behind the establishment of Harry's Haven, an Alzheimer's disease unit named after Douglas's father at the Motion Picture and Television Fund home in Woodland Hills. The couple was also known for their efforts to rebuild playgrounds in the Los Angeles Unified School District and would attend opening ceremonies in person.
That's amazing.
It's very sweet. In recognition of her philanthropic deeds as a private citizen, Anne received a Jefferson Award for public service in 2003. The Douglases, fun fact, are the only married couple who have both received a Jefferson Award.
Oh, that's funny.
He won his in, like, 1983, 1985, something like that.
Yeah.
So how did these two lovebirds get together? I mentioned earlier that they met on the set of a movie, but what's funny about this meeting is that Kirk did not give Anne the best first impression. Kirk was one of the biggest heartthrobs on the planet at this time, and he was apparently a very cocky guy about it.
Oh, my God.
He is quoted... yeah. He is quoted as confidently asking her to, quote, come back to the lion's den, which was the name for Kirk's trailer. Ew. Kirk, oh my God. And asked her out a few times over the course of them working together.
Oh my God.
Are we remembering that currently he is in a relationship with someone else?
Oh my God.
That's not quote, great. Unquote, committed relationship?
Yeah.
In an interview with the Los Angeles Times, Kirk said, I thought, I'll take this young beauty to dinner at the most romantic and expensive restaurant in Paris, La Tour d'Argent. She's sure to approve of my taste and my ability to get a last-minute reservation. Anne was not impressed and responded, no, thank you. I think I'll go home and make myself some scrambled eggs.
That is so funny. Oh, my God.
I love her. In an interview with USA Today, Kirk said, she was the most difficult woman I've ever met. I mean, I was a big movie star, and I invited her to dinner, and she said, oh, thank you very much, but I'm so tired.
Exhausted. It's like when I say I'm tired, and then I go and look at my phone until, like, midnight.
It's even more than that, though, because she didn't say she was tired. She said, I would rather have scrambled eggs all by myself than go to dinner with you at this fancy restaurant.
Oh, my God.
Just it was after all eggs. Of these interactions that Anne accepted a job as his publicist, and Kirk said the relationship was entirely platonic until he, quote, stopped talking about myself and began to listen to her.
Oh, that is the committed to me trait, isn't it?
Right? It's very cute. Anne said she later fell for him at a charity gala held at a circus, where Kirk scooped elephant dung while dressed in a full tuxedo. She told USA Today, it was not only funny, it was showing me that he was able to do things that are not expected from him. So that's kind of like the works hard.
Hard worker. Also, like, going back up to them, fun to be with and positive. Right. That definitely sounds like that.
They got married in 1954 and had two children together, adding to two sons that Kirk had from a previous marriage.
I'm honestly impressed that they had a 66-year relationship, and he also had another marriage. That's like...
Yeah, what the hell?
I mean, they did live to their hundreds. They had time.
They did both live into their hundreds. Long lives. Their marriage was exceedingly loving and caring, though through letters published in the book Kirk and Anne, we can see how adoring they are towards each other. For example, Anne sent Kirk a letter in 1956 while he was traveling that said, "I am so sad and depressed. I don't think I ever want to be near you as much as right now. The toilet paper is too hard, the coffee is too strong, the telephones are impossible. Don't I sound like a true American? But even being a European broad, what on earth am I doing here?" Kirk sent Anne a letter while filming on location in Munich in 1957 that said, "Darling, how is it that when I am away from you, such love for you overwhelms me at 2:30 in the morning, as it is now. I awake to write to you. How incomplete I seem without my family. How can a man live alone? To live just for yourself is to be dead. And yes, I welcome this parting from you to rekindle my awareness of how much you mean to me. The early hour brings out the poetic side of me."
Oh my God. That's a lot.
And... yeah, and I also included a bunch of cute photos of them together to show Siri just how they acted and interacted with each other in public.
They look very loving, but not in a, like, not in a fake way, if that makes sense. Just very comfortable.
They're very classy. Yeah. And I noticed that every photo of them together, one of them is looking at the other one, and they're always laughing and sitting close to each other, or he's always touching her. He's always... in this position where he's, like, either actively touching her or holding her arm or brushing against her. Their knees are touching in one of these photos. Like, he's always actively touching her. I think it's very cute.
Yeah, I mean, from their letters, from the pictures, from everything, they definitely meet many of the most important qualities people have endorsed, like faithful, committed, positive, fun to be with, shared interests, like, with the philanthropy, like... it really makes sense.
Here's where it gets dicey.
Uh-oh, I don't feel good about this. My tummy hurts.
And why I went back and forth between talking about one of three relationships other than this one for a while. When Siri and I started planning this topic, I mentioned that I would not be including any couples that had affairs during the relationship. Unfortunately, Kirk was later open about his dalliances with a few women during their relationship. I guess luckily for them, Anne never seemed bothered by it, and it seems that they may have had an arrangement within their marriage, but that's my own personal speculation, because I've seen her talk about it quite a bit, and I can't really parse out anything other than that in her words. So in the book Kirk and Anne, she said, "Kirk never tried to hide his dalliances from me. As a European, I understood it was unrealistic to expect total fidelity in a marriage. Kirk secured my permission before including stories of his trysts. I'm positive his candor helped him make the book a major bestseller." Anne has never revealed whether or not she had affairs during their time together, nor do I think anyone ever asked her.
So I guess there's two things.
I wish they had.
Here, one of them in a very non-romantic thing is that one of the most important parts of being in a long-term relationship is making compromises. And if they could make this compromise that he can have occasional affairs as long as he doesn't hide them and he remains committed to her, that is a compromise. I find it interesting that nobody, I guess I don't, I'm disappointed that, you know, I'm not even disappointed because it was up to her. If she had extramarital affairs and she didn't want to talk about them, that's up to her.
Oh, but I want
to know. I just want to know. Anne. I know, I want to know.
Anne, why are you hiding this from me? But also, so, before we even started this podcast, I was still, like, furiously Googling things, trying to find out whether or not she had ever talked about her dalliances.
Right.
As a European, she understands it's unrealistic to expect total fidelity in a marriage.
That's the thing. Yeah.
So she came into this marriage as a European lady, not thinking that she would be expected to remain faithful to him either. But I like to imagine she was with gorgeous French models, but she never ever confirmed or denied.
I mean, the more realistic thing, right, is that at this point in time, when she says, "I understand it was unrealistic to expect total fidelity in a marriage," probably the unsaid rest of the sentence was for men. So.
That is true. That would be very disappointing. And she specifically said that he secured her permission before talking about them.
Right. That was interesting because she said he never tried to hide his dalliances. He secured my permission before including stories. So I guess it makes sense. So throughout their marriage, he didn't try to hide them. And then when they were writing the book together, I guess, he was like, hey, is it okay if I talk about them? She was like, okay.
Yes. I am so curious about Anne.
Yeah.
Anne saved Kirk in many ways during their time together, from using her business savvy to rescue his finances and saving him millions from a fraudulent business manager.
Oh my god.
That situation was so hilarious. So she was his publicist, so she started asking questions about finances and budgets and all these things related to his working and business.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, was very clueless, apparently.
Oh my god.
I mean, you know how men are with money. Like, he just had no really clue. And so she tried to get in contact with his business manager, and at first he kept on dodging her or giving her, like, wishy-washy answers. Yes. And finally she, like, questioned him enough and got through and found out that Kirk Douglas was pretty much broke.
Oh my god.
And it was because of this guy. And so she got rid of him and sort of took over and helped him out with that and dug him out of that hole.
That is insane.
Yeah. And she also insisted, this is a very interesting one, she insisted that he not fly on a private plane with director Mike Todd, and I think there were a few other people on board as well. And this plane later crashed and left no survivors.
What was her reason for him not flying on the plane?
She said she had a bad dream, and then as the days went on, she couldn't shake that feeling, and it just got worse and worse, and she was getting more and more nervous about his trip. And he's been traveling a bit at this point, mm-hmm. But she sort of laid down the law on this one, and they got into a huge fight about it, and she basically said, if you go, fuck you. Like, we're done. Seriously, you're not listening to me on this. I don't think you should go, and you're not trusting me. And so he decided not to go, and then he would have died on that plane.
That is insane.
I'm not saying she's prophetic. I'm just saying she's got good instincts. Kirk has said on many occasions that his life was saved in many ways by Anne, as well as saying, quote, I don't know why Anne stuck with me through those early decades. If anyone I worked with is still alive, they will attest that I wasn't Mr. Popularity. I had a lot of anger, matched by a lot of arrogance. Some people will put up with me, I think, simply because I had such a wonderful wife.
Oh my god.
So at least you're self-aware.
Yeah. Or he became self-aware.
It's true. It does seem like their relationship got better as it went on.
Aged like fine wine.
Exactly. In 1996, Kirk suffered from a stroke, while at the same time Anne was suffering from her second fight with breast cancer. Although doctors described it as a minor stroke, Kirk has been very open about how difficult the recovery process was in his book, My Stroke of Luck. He said he suffered from severe depression and had a lot of issues with rage. After spending so much time on screen as a tough guy and surviving things like a helicopter crash several years before and poverty, he felt unceremoniously sidelined. While the stroke didn't cause any instances of paralysis, his speech was badly impaired.
Mm.
He described the experience as it felt as if a pointed object drew a line from his right temple down to his cheek. When he tried to describe the strange sensation, gibberish came out, but this didn't stop him from putting out movies. He said, after a stroke, I made 2 films with impaired speech. Now I'm waiting for another part to play before the sun sinks below the horizon. You can't stop an actor.
Seriously, that is crazy.
That's so scary.
Yeah, oh yeah. Strokes are really scary. I can't believe that he... It was like before he was even fully recovered when he still had impaired speech. I don't know if that lasted forever, but he was like, meh, I'm good.
Tough guy. In 2004, the couple sadly lost their youngest son, the comedian Eric Douglas, to an accidental overdose.
Mm.
And after going through so much together, the couple renewed their vows on their 50th anniversary in 2004 and hosted a large wedding that they had always dreamed of but didn't have the funds for when they originally got married. Anne surprised Kirk before the ceremony by revealing that she had converted to Judaism.
Oh, wow. 50 years in, she's like, yeah, sure.
It takes a while, you know. It's a lot of classes.
Does that mean that their children became Jewish at that point?
Their children are Jewish.
Right, but I mean, because she wasn't Jewish before, overnight they became Jewish through the matrilineal line.
No, I don't think so, because they were raised Jewish and they've always been Jewish. Like us.
That is so funny. 50 years.
Okay. Also, that mom thing, we know how overblown that is.
That's true.
And also, this, so that started mainly around the Holocaust, and because of the Holocaust, and remember, they met during World War II, so that probably wasn't as in big of effect at this point.
Right.
Because surprisingly enough, that is not a tenet of being Jewish.
Yeah.
In his collection of short stories and poems, Kirk wrote a poem called Romance Begins at 80, which reads, Romance begins at 80, and I ought to know. I live with a girl who will tell you so.
He should probably keep his day job. It's cute.
Once you get famous, people will support you doing anything.
So funny. It's cute, but it's so funny.
That's not even a haiku.
No, it's not a haiku. He's 80, though. Give it to him. That is so sweet. It seems like, yeah, I mean, every marriage has ups and downs. I wouldn't say that every marriage has infidelity, but they're very pragmatic about it, or at least.
That is a very interesting detail. I can't get over that.
Yeah. And no, that's interesting.
And it's not like he kept up over the years with the affairs.
Right. It was like one-offs.
Well, not a one-off. There were a few. But it all happened earlier on.
No, but that's what I mean. Yeah, like a couple right. women over the years. It's interesting.
That was strange.
66 years. That's pretty successful.
66 years. They make it work. They both look pretty good still.
They're so
hey, wonderful. They lived over 100 each. So.
They did. Yeah, I kind of wanted to ask, like, what was their cardio routine? Like, what did they eat?
Something they were doing it right.
Oh my god. That is so cool. Well, I'm happy with this episode. It doesn't leave me as, like, personally distressed as the last one.
That last one got a little disturbing in moments.
Yeah, I like this one. I mean, moral of the story.
Palate cleanser.
Like, if you want to be in a long-term relationship, look for someone who is trustworthy and faithful and committed to you, fun, positive.
And maybe ugly.
Maybe ugly, yeah.
Give them a chance.
It doesn't really matter when you're 100 anyway, how attractive they are.
Exactly. Well, I will see you all next week.
Yes. Thank you for listening. Bye.